Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to have a great conversation about a topic that's so important for all of us to know about, because this show is all about empowering you with truthful information so you can make those really appropriate decisions for your health and well-being. And as always, you will find the show totally enlightening and inspiring, and I think really important to help you make really good choices. So what are we talking about today? We're talking about a new best-selling book. I think it's a New York Times best-selling book, A Mind of Your Own with Dr. Kelly Brogan. We're going to be talking about the truth about depression and how women can heal their bodies to reclaim their lives. I just want to give you a brief statistic here that was really shocking to me. And that statistic is more than 30 million of us take antidepressants, including 1 in 7 women, 1 in 4 women of reproductive age, which is such a shocking statistic, especially since there has never been a single study that has proven that depression is caused by chemical imbalance in the brain requiring medication. So there is a lot we're going to be talking about. This happens to be one of the topics that I am really passionate about, and I am so honored to have Dr. Kelly Brogan with us today. A little bit about Dr. Brogan. She studied cognitive neuroscience at MIT before receiving her MD from the Weill Cornell Medical College. She's board certified in psychiatry, psychosomatic medicine, and integrative holistic medicine. And she is one of the only doctors in the nation with these qualifications. She is also on the faculty of George Washington University. When not helping patients in her Manhattan private practice, publishing groundbreaking research, teaching, or advocating for holistic women's psychiatry, she is on radio shows like this, getting the message out. So, Dr. Kelly Brogan, thank you so much for your time today. I know you have a really busy practice, so it's such a pleasure that you've made time to be with us today.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Well, you so deserve it, and this is such a important topic. It's a topic that I have been personally raving about and, you know, standing on my soapbox, because I see it in my practice as such a major problem, women who are being put on these medications with dire consequences that they have never been told about. Mm-hmm. So we're going to spend this time together, this hour, really diving into the whole issue of depression and anxiety, which, by the way, Kelly, I've had in my life. They were, you know, weights around my neck for a really long time before I unraveled the pieces that contributed to depression and anxiety. So I know it's possible to do that, and I know that without a roadmap, women are lost and confused, and it's really easy to, you know, go for a pill to help, but that's not the solution. So that's what I want to do, is I want to explore the whole story here, and I think a good place to start is to look at the statistics around depression and anxiety, particularly in women, because women seem to be more vulnerable to this than men.
Yes. So, you know, to sort of zoom out first, it's important to acknowledge that depression is actually the number one cause of disability, according to the World Health Organization, worldwide right now. And there are 11% of Americans taking antidepressants. And as you mentioned, 1 in 4 women of reproductive age, which happens to be the demographic that I have specialized in, are being treated with antidepressants. So we have essentially a silent epidemic on our hands, right? And in my opinion, when we're looking at this ever-escalating incidence, we have to begin to ask the question, why, right? So why are people struggling? Why are they being labeled in this way? What is going on? And what's interesting is that in conventional medical training, we are never encouraged to ask that question. It's almost an irrelevant question, right? Because it has nothing to do with suppressing the symptoms, which is the mandate of, you know, pharmaceutically based medicine. So, you know, why you have depression has little impact on taking an antidepressant, because if the idea is just to get your symptoms gone, then it doesn't matter, you know, what's causing them. And so that's really where I began to sort of peel the layers of the onion back and understand, in fact, that depression is not the disease that we think it is.
Well, I think the question that we're going to be exploring is depression a disease?
Yeah.
You know, and that is such a really important question, because if a person, a man or a woman, is experiencing depression and they go to see their doctor, the doctor will give them a prescription for some sort of either antidepressant medication or perhaps a minor tranquilizer to help them deal with their anxiety. And, you know, you have 15 minutes, right? You walk in,
right.
You talk about the problem, and you walk out with a prescription without being told about the risks and side effects.
That's
so maybe we should talk about the risks and side effects from taking these medications, because they are not without risks and side effects.
That is for sure. And as you've alluded to, you know, in so many ways, psychiatry and psychiatric medications have become the wastebasket for all of the limitations of conventional medicine to meet the, you know, ever more complex health challenges of the modern population, right? So as you said, you know, when you have 10 minutes and you present to your family practice doctor, you know, family practice doctors prescribe almost 3/4 of the antidepressant prescriptions in this country. And, you know, you have 10 minutes, you talk about how you have brain fog and your joints ache and you have digestive problems and your mood feels flat and you feel forgetful and tired all the time and you can't concentrate and you can't sleep well. You know, rather than digging in to investigate what might be some of the reversible causes of these, you know, essentially lifestyle symptoms, it's the only tool made available to us in our training is to really write antidepressant prescriptions in these cases, or maybe hypnotics, as you said, or anti-anxiety medications. It's the simplest way to feel like you're helping your patient. You know, doctors are, by and large, very good people, well-meaning individuals, right, who are interested in offering, you know, their patients tools to relieve suffering. It's just that we aren't given the full picture, as you mentioned. You know, we aren't given the full picture of what non-industry-funded literature tells us about the potential risks and really largely the inefficacy of these medications. And that's what really, you know, dropped my jaw to the floor when I began to look at the research that I wasn't told about in my training. You know, I'm, you know, sort of constructed as a natural skeptic, and so I always want to form my own opinion about everything. You know, even in the natural health realm, I want to form my own opinion about, does everyone need to take vitamin D, or does everyone, you know, benefit from fish oil? And I always am interested in looking just like one layer or so deeper than the consensus. And so what I began to find was that these medications are dangerous in ways that I never informed a single patient that I prescribed to in the history of my career. And the most concerning part is that the dangerousness, the risks, and the possibility for adverse events is completely unpredictable at this point, right? So I'll give you one example, which sounds really sensational, and I sort of, you know, dismissed it for years in my training because this signal of harm began to emerge when I was in residency, and it's around the potential for SSRI, antidepressants, to cause impulsive violence, right? So we began to see this signal of harm in the pediatric population, where children were being prescribed these medications, despite the fact that the literature did not support the safety or efficacy of this, and they were killing themselves, right? I was taught in my training to explain that away by saying, oh, well, they had suicidal, you know, ideation, it's called suicidal ideation, before they were treated, and then they were just feeling a little more energized, and so they went ahead and did it. Right, like we were literally fed party line dismissal of what the research was actually demonstrating. And the amazing part is that this research was suppressed. You know, there's a famous case, Study 329, where GlaxoSmithKline was ordered to pay multi-billion dollar settlement for essentially ghostwriting and hiding, manipulating, and data dredging the research that encouraged pediatric psychiatrists to prescribe to children medications that were absolutely demonstrated in their own studies to be very dangerous. And so in the adult population, no one is talking about this, right? But in the published literature, we have cases. You know, one of the most impactful case studies I've looked at is a case of 10 impulsive violent outbursts resulting in homicide in people who were medicated with antidepressants, and within sometimes even a couple of doses, otherwise a couple of weeks of initiating medication, these otherwise totally normal citizens went on to murder their spouses, murder their children, sometimes spend the rest of their lives in jail because of it. And it was because of what is deemed to be an intoxication syndrome. Again, no one screening for who, you know, could this happen to you? Well, it turns out that the people who, you know, were victimized by this side effect, if you want to call it that, in effect, right, had a variant in their liver enzyme that essentially put them into a serotonin syndrome so that they weren't metabolizing the medication in an expected way, and they were essentially intoxicated when they completed these violent acts. Well, I never told a single patient that I prescribed to that it's possible, you know, this could result in an altered state of consciousness that, you know, would lead you to commit heinous crimes. You know, I certainly never had that conversation with a single patient. So this gives you some idea of the true gravity of what we are treating as, you know, almost like a vitamin or something that you pop into your doctor, and why not take the edge off, you know, with a prescription that could help, and if it doesn't, then whatever. But we're not having the types of conversations that we need to for true informed consent. And that's just one category of risk that we've touched on, right?
So that really needs to be emphasized. It's a really big point, and that is that antidepressants in some people can lead to suicidal ideation, suicidal actions. Actually, people have committed suicide when they were prescribed those drugs, and not very soon after. And also, it can create such violence and rage that it can lead to homicidal behaviors and actions. And there's a woman you probably know of, Tracy Ann Blake, I think, who has a website, drugawareness.org, who is an expert witness who goes around defending these people who have committed murders to their loved ones because they didn't know that they were they thought they were having a bad dream, but they were awake.
Right.
And I have to tell you a really personal story. One of the side effects of these SSRIs is that it because it so alters your metabolism of your serotonin and the pathways. I had a family member who was put on an SSRI, not for depression, but more for pain. And he woke up one morning, looked in the mirror, and his face was, like, bloodied. It looked like someone had taken a baseball bat to his face.
Wow.
And he had, he woke up this way, and he had 3 fractured ribs, lacerations throughout his body, and no memory.
Wow.
No memory of how that happened, and immediately taken to the hospital, taken off his SSRIs, you know, spent a couple of days recovering from all the consequences of what happened, and he had no memory. He just remembered lying down on his sofa, you know, taking a nap and, you know, getting
that
up in the morning.
Incredible.
And what actually happened was he was sleepwalking, and he got up and fell down a flight of steps into the basement because they found blood at the bottom of the basement steps. That's the only way they knew what happened to him. And he could have broken his neck. He could have died. And
I mean, and it's dismissed, right? It's like, oh, well, that's so rare. You know what? But when you're the one victimized, you don't care about how rare it is.
It's
irrelevant.
Is it rare? Is it rare? What do you think? What do you have any stats on how frequently people experience violent behaviors, sleepwalking, suicidal behaviors? Any stats on that?
We don't have those stats, and you know why? Because there's not mandated reporting, and also because there's so often the link is dismissed. You know, there is a website, you know, similar to Tracy's SSRI stories.org, and David Healy is a psychiatrist out of the UK who's had, you know, really dedicated his career to exposing the unpublished and manipulated literature that conceals this signal of harm. And it goes through, this website goes through all of the media making cases of school shootings, you know, pilots taking planes down, mothers killing their newborn babies, and all of them are these similar cases of patients recently started or recently actually tapered off, which is a whole other conversation, of these medications. And so, you know, have you heard about that in the media? Is anybody actually making these connections? No, they're all being done behind the scenes. There certainly aren't, you know, controlled trials examining this. In fact, all of the controlled trials are attempting to conceal it. So we don't have those statistics. And frankly, again, what does it matter to you if you are the individual playing Russian roulette who is victimized by these circumstances? You don't care if it's a 1% incidence. Especially when, you know, the efficacy of these medications is questionable at best. Is it ever worth it? Seems to me it's not.
I think it's all too common, actually. So any other side effects from antidepressants, from SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors? Anything else that we
need to
be aware of?
Sure. I mean, listen, like any pharmaceutical product, there's a laundry list of potential side effects. But I would say the one that is least popularized and really most commonly debilitating is the one I've developed some unintentional expertise in, which is the withdrawal syndromes associated with these medications, right? So as long as we are led to believe that antidepressants are fixing a chemical imbalance, which is, of course, what we are told by direct-to-consumer advertising, you know, that is happening, right? So as long as we're led to believe that, then we would never expect that chronic use of these medications would cause us problems, right? But it's important that we recognize the fact that these medications, as psychiatrist Joanna Moncrief, who's written tremendous work about the myth of the chemical cure, as she calls it, you know, as she says, these medications are having a drug-based effect, not a disease-based effect. So they're not resolving any discrete disease entity, right? They're having a drug-based effect, not unlike if you were to drink alcohol for your social anxiety, have some, you know, temporary relief, let's say, of your social anxiety when you have two shots of vodka before you go to a party. You wouldn't be surprised that if you were to do that every single day as a treatment, after 10 years of doing that, if you were to abruptly stop your quote-unquote treatment, you wouldn't be surprised if you would, you know, end up in pretty rough shape, right? Maybe with delirium tremens or seizures or, you know, acute withdrawal. So what happens is that when we actually look at these medications for what they are, which is chemicals that force the body to adapt and habituate to this exposure, then it's not going to be surprising when patients enter into acute and potentially complex withdrawal syndromes when they try to get off these medications, right? So again, we are taught in our training to tell patients that the symptoms that emerge in the setting of medication discontinuation are actually evidence of relapse, right, and only further confirm the need for chronic use. But the literature is finally catching up with the fact that patients have been screaming from the mountaintops over the internet, you know, about these withdrawal symptoms, and the literature is finally catching up. And in fact, there was a definitive landmark paper in 2014 that essentially equated antidepressants with barbiturates and other habit-forming medications and called this exactly what it is, which is a withdrawal syndrome, not a relapse. So coming off of these medications can be extremely, extremely disabling. I mean, when I started to take patients off of medication years ago, I was essentially, before I developed my approach, you know, I was essentially running like an outpatient rehab. I mean, I spent half my day filling out medical disability forms because my patients were so sick, you know, based on the withdrawal syndrome, essentially. So this is something, again, before you fill that first prescription, you should know that, you know, no doctor is going to be incentivized to take you off of medication. There's so much liability in that. And so you could very easily end up taking it for a decade. And not only does the long-term data demonstrate unequivocally that it's not going to help you, you're not going to do better long-term. There's not a single study that says taking medication long-term results in better outcomes. So not only is it not going to help you, but it actually could really harm you because it can disable your body's ability to re-equilibrate, you know, to readapt after you come off it. And, you know, all you have to do is go on to, you know, surviving antidepressants, you know, or Beyond Meds or MadInAmerica.com, and you'll see that patients are essentially helping patients because doctors like me are not trained to help patients come off of medication. Absolutely not. So I don't even think I had an hour of supervision or mentorship on this subject. So everything that I know about this, I have learned from patients, amazingly. And it is such an important topic for patients to explore before beginning medications. And, you know, it's not to dishearten anyone who is thinking about coming off medication because, obviously, you know, I do this every single day, and I believe passionately that it's always worth a try. It's always possible, and that the body does have incredible resiliency, but you have to help yourself, you know, optimize that. But it's just such a critical, you know, sort of like untold story.
It is an untold story, and it's an important story that it needs to be told, which is why I'm just, you know, just so thrilled that you've written this book and the message is getting out there. And we're going to get into all of the root cause issues that drive what we call depression in a little bit, but I just have to share with you this story. I was having a conversation with a friend, and she was saying how difficult her sleep was, that she was having a really hard time getting sleep. She was getting really bad dreams. This is a woman, actually, I didn't know at all. And I just said, are you on antidepressants?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she said that the dreams are really disturbing and quite violent. You know, it's like, oh, my God, the red lights are flashing. I said, are you on antidepressants? She goes, yes, I am, and my doctor's helping me to wean off. I'm in the process of weaning off. And I said, well, how are you weaning off? She goes, well, my doctor and I kind of, you know, he went through all these books and we tried to find the best, you know, solution and the best drugs to help me wean off. I go, you go back to your doctor immediately because it is not working what he's doing. He doesn't know what he's doing. And the important point of this whole story is that weaning off, if not done correctly, could have that rebound effect that can make you as violent or suicidal as if you were on it. So that's the other missing piece to this puzzle. You cannot go cold turkey off of these medications.
Well, forget about cold turkey. You can't even do like a quarter of the dose a month. I mean, even that is too fast. And so you can't even blame our doctor. How is he supposed to know? You know, we're literally not taught this in our training. And if we are taught, it's sort of like some hand-waving, like, you know, sort of common sense, well, why, you know, just come down by a quarter of a dose a week or something like that. That should be fine. It's out of their system, and, you know, half-life is 10 hours out of their system. It should, you know, it's gone, right? So, you know, what we've found, again, through patient-led experience, is that a more typical pace is about 10%. Of the dose. So we're talking, you know, about if you're on 150 milligrams of Zoloft, we're talking about the first dose being, you know, 12 and a half milligrams or 15 milligrams, the first decrement, and that the pace would be something like every 2 to 4 weeks as a starting pace to see what you can tolerate. And the withdrawal phenomenon I've learned from my clinical experience has two phases, right? So there's the initial phase where it's in the first, you know, I would say 2 to 3 days of a dose change where you can have some acute physical symptoms like headache or brain zaps or gastrointestinal symptoms. And those are typically transient because the body does adapt, you know, relatively easily to that. But then there's the more insidious wave, which comes, in my experience, almost like clockwork when it does, which is not always, 2 months after a change. So you begin to have this layering effect as you come down off of medication, which can sometimes become challenging over time, you know, as you get to the tinier doses, or you get to the final dose, you think you're home free, and then 2 months later, and this is what crops up in the literature, you develop symptoms that you never even had before, you know, insomnia or, you know, sort of like impulsive, you know, sort of outbursts and agitation, really dark moods, suicidality, and you think, oh, God, I need to get back on it after all that work. But this is a very typical, you know, and who know, we don't, I could postulate why, but we don't really know why. And so this could even happen if you're going, you know, at a responsible pace. So I have never, I mean, what chemical on the planet is like this? I mean, do you hear of people needing to come off of heroin or OxyContin or crack cocaine at this pace? I mean, there's not a chemical on the planet that I believe to be as habit-forming as antidepressants. I mean, it's, so, I just can't be convinced otherwise.
So let me ask you very specifically, do you advise your patients to cut their pills? Do you prescribe a lower dose? How does one actually get to that one-tenth?
Great question. So, you know, my goal with this book, and, you know, I have a online course coming out as a companion. My goal is to put this in the hands of patients so they can do this on their own, right? I don't think, you know, the protocol that I've outlined, I don't think it's necessary to even work with a clinician, you know, to move through these lifestyle steps. Now, the exception is if you're on medication and you want to come off it, you have to work with someone, first of all, a prescriber, and second of all, someone who can at least, you know, consult with someone who has a bit of experience, because it's really not rocket science. You know, it's math in the end, coming down on medication doses. But you have to work with a compounding pharmacy. I have a longstanding relationship with Johnson Compounding in Massachusetts. They're extremely expert in this, you know, in this very uncharted realm of psychotropic medication discontinuation, and they can compound for me, and I trust them implicitly and their facility. They can compound for me any dose that I want. I have some patients that I take off of SSRIs at 1/1000th of a milligram a month, believe it or not. And, you know, that's rare, obviously, but it is something that can be accommodated, because the pharmaceutical industry obviously doesn't make it very easy for you to have many choices for dose decrements, right? So sometimes you're working with, like, you know, Wellbutrin, for example, you have to go 50% decrease from, you know, 300 to 150. Those are the only dosages even available, and that's not going to work most of the time. So you have to use a compounding pharmacy, or some medications are available in liquid preparations through conventional pharmacies, so that also is an option. But you want to really get into those smaller doses so you can minimize essentially the shock to the system.
And what about nutrition? What nutrition do you recommend to help people wean off and you know, rebalance their neurotransmitters again, and being able to produce them, and, you know, so just support that process of reestablishing balance once more?
So this is where the money's at, right? This is the most important question of the hour. And remember when I was saying that I was running this sort of outpatient rehab, right? That was after I had read Robert Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and I said, I'm never starting a patient on a medication again. I'm done. And I began to offer my patients the option to come off of their medication, right? And I sort of, you know, felt so enthusiastically about this that I, you know, had been working with a lot of these patients for years. I was often the one who started them on medication, even in my residency, right? I had a long relationship with a lot of these women. And so we hadn't been talking about diet. It just wasn't something we talked about. I wasn't trained to care. In fact, I was trained to really see it as largely an irrelevant variable, relative to the disease entity, you know, which is their psychiatric illness, right? So, you know, and anybody who's been to medical school will tell you that they had no more than 1 hour of nutrition unless they pursued, you know, a personal interest. It's just not in the curriculum. And there's actually papers that verify this very, you know, sort of concerning fact. So when I began to work with these patients, I'd never talked about diet. And so I said, well, let's just see how it works, how it goes to come off of your medication. And it was horrific. You know, I didn't have a single success. My patients were falling apart at the seams. And, you know, around that time, I had put my own autoimmune thyroid condition into remission. So I began to learn through my own experience with a naturopath. You know, I had, at the time, I wasn't raised really, you know, like a hippie, and I wasn't a new agey kind of person. And I, you know, I really had come from this belief system around conventional medicine being real medicine. And then I was diagnosed with my first health condition. You know, postpartum, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's. And I said, well, I don't want to take a medication for the rest of my life. You know, this sucks. And so it was from that place that I had the sense to consult a naturopath here in New York City, Nicole Eigenberger, and she essentially helped me to change my diet. Now, I was raised Italian, so eating bread and cheese is something I did probably 5 times a day. I, you know, never exercised, meditating, I didn't even know what that meant. I was, you know, incredibly hyper-stressed all the time throughout my training, and yet I was motivated to listen to her because I didn't want to have to deal with a health problem. Right? And for whatever reason, I had the intuition to pursue this, because it's really weird to me looking back that I even did that, right? And of course, that changed the game for me, because not only did I put what should be a chronic and potentially even debilitating autoimmune disorder into remission, but then I ultimately even got off natural hormone, and I showed myself experientially that nutrition not only matters, but it actually can accomplish things that I was told in my training aren't even possible. Right, shouldn't even be expectations. So that was a real red flag for me when I began to say, you know, I wasn't told the whole story in my training. I suspected that, and now look, it's true. So,
this is a good. We need to take a break. We'll just take a moment. We'll do our break. But I want to also tell you that I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and I healed it by addressing the root cause issues, which we're going to talk about when we come back, all the drivers for depression and anxiety and the many options and solutions naturally that are available to us. So everyone, stay tuned. We're talking to Dr. Kelly Brogan, author of A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression, How Women Can Heal Their Bodies to Reclaim Their Lives, a really important book, profound information. So do stay tuned. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and we'll be right back. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're talking to Dr. Kelly Brogan, author of A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression and How Women Can Heal Their Bodies to Reclaim Their Lives. A really, really important conversation, since women are more vulnerable to depression. I always like to add anxiety in there as well, because that was something I dealt with for a long time before I understood what it was, and those the Xanax, the Valium, the minor tranquilizers are so addictive. Within 2 weeks, they can make you addictive and make you feel crazy, but you think it's you and not the drugs, and they're really hard to wean off of as well, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. But that, at least that's well acknowledged, right? At least I think everybody knows, and in fact, there's some legislation even in Massachusetts pending now to, you know, create sort of specially colored forms and all this stuff that patients actually see when they fill an anti-anxiety prescription, so they know they're taking a habit-forming medication. But I think it's, I assume it's sort of, you know, in the collective consciousness that these anti-anxiety medicines like Xanax and Valium are problematic, but people don't know that these other psychiatric medications are as well.
Well, I'm sure that's absolutely true, but what women don't know is how difficult it is to wean off minor tranquilizers, and how long it takes, and you know, just the protocol to do that. So, I mean, we're kind of all clumped together. We're given such little information about what's going on when we take these medications and how to ever help us safely and effectively and kindly, you know, wean off of them. So,
right.
You know, I've just seen that in my practice a lot. So let's go over, and we have so much to talk about.
Yes, I know.
So little time. Let's talk about what are those root causes. You know, if
as you have in your talking points here, which I think is really profound, and I'll just read it again, in 6 decades, not a single study has proven that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. Most people who are depressed think they have a chemical imbalance in their brain, correct? Wouldn't you
correct.
Say that? You know, so that's not ever been proven. It's not about a chemical imbalance in the brain. Let's talk about what it really is.
Right, and it's not about that because we're not talking about one thing. Right? So depression is actually, you know, I like to use the analogy, it's really just like a fever of the mind and body, right? So it's an indication mm-hmm. that the body is struggling to rebalance itself in the face of adversity, right? So that adversity can be chemical exposure, it can be a food intolerance, it can be stress, it can be psychospiritual, right? It can be from myriad different causes. It's sort of like, you know, if you say your toe is hurting, right? Well, why is it hurting? Did you drop a hammer on it? Do you have an infection in your toenail? Is there a string tied around it too tight, right? We have to know the why in order to identify, you know, a method and a means to reverse it. So it's no wonder that a one-size-fits-all pharmaceutical approach to this is ineffective, right, which, of course, is what the literature bears out, much to the chagrin of practicing psychiatrists. You know, it's really tough to argue with at this point that these medications are ineffective. And it's not surprising because we're applying one, chemical product to essentially one, to, you know, many, many, many different, this chimeric, you know, picture of many, many different possible roads to similar symptoms. And so the most important thing is to begin to send the body a signal of safety. So where we left off before the break, I was discussing the fact that once I started to prioritize dietary change, my success with weaning patients off of medications skyrocketed. You know, there was like a before and after in my clinical practice. And so I've become very militant, actually, and it's, you know, I have super motivated patients, so it's easy to do. But I've become very strict and rigid about the importance of 100% compliance to at least 30 days of a whole foods organic diet before we even touch your medication. So there is no taper happening if that does not happen. And the reason I feel so strongly about it is, again, because I saw what happens if you try to engage in this body stressor when your bucket is already full. So what we aim to do with these lifestyle interventions is really drain that bucket so that you have more of a reserve to tolerate stress and to, you know, recruit resiliency around what, as we've been discussing, a very stressful exposure. So part of what I do with patients, and again, this is all outlined in the book, this is exactly what I do with patients when I meet with them, is while they're doing that 30-day diet, we begin to look at some diagnostics. These are basic blood tests, sort of the best we can do with the parameters available now, to begin to try and better understand, you know, what might have been the root cause of what led them to consider medication in the first place. And so I talk about some of the most common drivers of psychiatric labeling and treatment, which if you don't identify them, you could end up, you know, for example, taking Zoloft for a thyroid condition. You know, if you look, and as somebody who also experienced it, right, like if you look at the symptoms of Hashimoto's, you will find that they line up almost identically with the symptoms of major depression, right? The picture of major depression mm-hmm. today is not, you know, a woman languishing on the couch in melancholy wishing for death, right? The picture of depression today, or what gets called depression, is mood flatness, it's overwhelm, it's anxiety, irritability, it's forgetfulness and poor concentration, it's fatigue. This is what depression looks like in America today. And this is also what Hashimoto's looks like in America today, right? And always, you know, a diagnosis of depression has this sort of, you know, consulate of other physical problems, right? So again, whether it's joint pain or constipation, gas and bloating, dry skin and hair loss, you know, it can be acne or other sort of skin rashes. So there's a picture of more global autoimmune reaction often accompanying what is just being diagnosed as a chemical imbalance in the brain. It's almost absurd, right? So when we look at the possibility of diagnosing a thyroid condition when you're primarily concerned with your psychiatric symptoms, well, that's sort of like a gold mine, right? Because there are countless people just like you and me who have put Hashimoto's into remission. It's completely doable. In fact, it might be one of the easiest autoimmune conditions to be put into remission. And you would never want to medicate an autoimmune thyroid condition with an SSRI. It's like makes as much sense as taking Tylenol for a piece of glass in your foot, right? So that's a really common one. And I work with women. I've probably diagnosed Hashimoto's in over 80% of my patients.
Or any thyroid imbalance could cause depression.
Yes. I see Graves' disease much, much less commonly, but I always check for the antibodies for both. And because I work a lot with the postpartum population, postpartum thyroiditis is often a blend of both. So you can have both kinds of antibodies for hyper and hypothyroidism. Sometimes, actually, postpartum thyroiditis resolves on its own, just the natural course of it. Because of the, you know, immune shifts that are, you know, sort of native to postpartum window. But in that time period of resolution, it can really account for some pretty gnarly stuff, including even postpartum psychosis. You know, there's a body of literature that implicates autoimmune thyroid activity in the postpartum period with, like, pretty severe psychiatric symptoms. So you want to know about it. I always check antibodies in my patients, you know, even 4 weeks postpartum, even if they're feeling well, because I want to sort of see what's potentially brewing. And so this is the first thing that anyone postpartum should be wondering about if you're struggling. It's the first, in my opinion, it's the first place to look.
Can I just jump in? I think it's important to say that antidepressant medications can create thyroid imbalances, right? They can impair the thyroid function.
Yes, that's possible. There is some literature that implicates even the, you know, fluoride compounds in medications like Prozac, for example, is interfering directly with thyroid production. But, you know, the draw on your bodily reserves, you know, that antidepressants are responsible for can really trigger unpredictably a lot of different secondary disease states. And that's true for any pharmaceutical product, right? Like, it's taken many, many years for birth control to be implicated in the development of a lot of gut and endocrine dysfunction and including immune reactivity. And I don't think we're ever going to have the smoking gun literature, but we certainly have correlation that is concerning. So, yeah. So that's sort of the first place to look, and then I'm very interested in blood sugar instability, and so even we're not even talking about diabetes necessarily, although there's very high overlap between diabetes and psychiatric illnesses like, you know, what is labeled as depression and anxiety. But what's more common in my practice is something called reactive hypoglycemia, which is essentially just sort of a roller coaster ride that, in fact, the very reasonable response of your blood sugar control hormone insulin to the types of foods that we typically consume, which overstimulate it, can really lead to a lot of what we are, again, calling ADHD, what we're calling panic attacks, what we're calling depression and anxiety. So what if what you think is your psychiatric illness is actually simply your body's response to the types of foods that you're eating? And that can, again, include some of the more immune-stimulating foods like wheat and dairy. So I go into the literature that it does exist, implicating wheat and dairy in psychiatric illness, not only because these foods can cause intestinal permeability, right? So like little spaces in between junctions in the intestinal wall that allow for immune stimulation and inflammatory responses that can impact brain health and function, but also because the metabolites of foods that contain wheat and dairy actually have direct effects on your brain chemistry and the opiate system specifically. And that happens throughout the body. So, you know, if you're somebody who has like one bowel movement a week, it could very well be because of the opiate-like effects of cow dairy protein, you know, called casein, on your gut motility, right? So we are not really used to exploring the psychoactive effects of our food, but a lot of what I think is so liberating about a whole foods diet is that you really peel away all the layers of addiction, right? So, like, you know, you take out the sugar, you take out the alcohol, you take out the coffee, you take out the bread, you take out the wheat, take out, you know, all of these foods that are putting us in a prison, right? We think we love them and we think we're entitled to them. We think life would be miserable without them. And believe me, I had all of those feelings when I, you know, 7 years ago, you know, went on this diet. And I can't tell you how liberating it is. I wouldn't dream, and you know what, neither would the hundreds of patients I've put on this diet, wouldn't dream of going back, because I actually feel like a pathos for people who are going through their day just like clamoring for the next, you know, stimulant. And it's just like it's an exhausting labor. And in fact, you know, there is a way to relate to food where it's just, you know, an enjoyable experience that takes your hunger away. That's it. You know, it's not something that you have this really complex relationship to, you know, that's really pulling you all over the map. So that's sort of like, I would say those are the two biggest ones. And then there are other considerations as well. But if you start there, you have a lot to work with.
And I think we need to add, because I have a whole long list of things that I've written down just from my experience. And when we talk about stress, when we talk about adrenal exhaustion, that could definitely be one of the causes for blood sugar imbalances.
Yes.
That roller coaster could be related to anxiety, could be related to depression, could be related to autoimmune conditions, which then lead to, you know, this whole...
It's a web, right?
Yeah,
and that's what makes this complicated, and it makes people not want to deal with it, because it's like, you know, when you are under extreme stress, you produce and secrete more cortisol, which raises your blood sugar, which provokes your insulin, you know, and it becomes this whole loop, like where is the chicken, where is the egg? They're all connected, right? Like, we really want to think of these different systems as being independent. That's what allopathic medicine is based on, right? You have your gastroenterologist and your endocrinologist and your nephrologist, and they all have their own specialty. Well, that's old science, right? And the newest science is systems-based biology that looks at the fundamental interconnectedness between all of these different regions, right? Like, my field is psychoneuroimmunology, right? So what is that about? It's about the connection between mind, brain, immune system, and implicitly, you know, gut and hormonal system. So it's all a web. And that's why we have to use these top-down interventions, right? That's why I don't typically recommend, like, the supplement miracle cure. I just haven't found that, you know, to be the reality, that there's, like, a one natural intervention that's going to be a slam dunk for you. You have to work with these complex tools, yeah.
And that's really the most profound message that I hear you saying. And you know, Pat, this is the message that I give out, that depression is a symptom. It's an indication that you are chronically out of balance in one or more systems of your body, that you need to address your lifestyle, you need to change your diet, you need to bring in exercise. It's life telling you that you are so out of balance that it's really hard to function optimally and use your potential. It's a wake-up call. And it's
exactly.
Not a drug that is going to restore your sense of well-being and joy. It is getting your life and your body healthy again.
Exactly. It's an invitation. And listen, it's your prerogative. You don't have to accept the invitation. If your priority is just punching the clock and getting to work every day until you die, you know, if that's what sounds like a fulfilling life experience for you,
that's
or your
enough to make
option,
you want to go on an antidepressant.
Right. Say it again.
Yeah. Oh, that thought that, you know, life is just about punching
well,
the clock.
Well, right.
And, you
but,
know,
you
that
know, that's what we're told. We're told stay functional, stay productive, get back to work. Who has time for this? There's no room for it. And you know what? There's a cost to that, right? It's like a whack-a-mole phenomenon. If you suppress it here, it's going to come up, you know, in some other way. And so you might as well sit with some curiosity, take some time to investigate, and figure out if this may actually be your wake-up call and your, you know, portal through which you're going to enter the next chapter of your life, which is going to be filled with an experience of vitality you never thought possible.
Yeah.
And any of us, you know, clinicians who have come to this belief system, I mean, you had the sense early on enough to work with naturopathic medicine. You know, the rest of us who were lured by conventional medicine, and those of us who come back to honor the body and the human organism in this way, you know, we've all had our wake-up calls. There's not one of us, you know, who hasn't had their own, you know, our own personal experience of disillusionment with the establishment. And so let it be that for you too, right? Like, it can absolutely be the fulcrum around which your life completely changes. And it won't do any of that if you only seek to get rid of your symptoms, right? So that's actually like a really powerful underlying message to any health struggle. And it may not be physiologic for you, but if it's, again, on a more psycho-spiritual level, then that's also something that you need to look at. Are you aligned with your purpose? You know, are you in the right relationships? Like, are you giving yourself enough pause? Or are you just always living in the future, expecting that plateau, you know, to come one day when you can feel happy? So I think that it's really a message across the board that it's time to sort of look critically at your life experience.
Well said. That's really profound. We only have a few minutes left, but I have this one question that we didn't really get to. Why are women more vulnerable than men? Not that men don't get depressed, but why are women more vulnerable? So can you answer that in a couple of minutes?
Yes. I mean, it seems to have something to do with the relationship between estrogen and the immune system. And it may even, on a meta level, have to do with the way that bacteria in our guts control both of those things. So we understand that men and women have really different arrays of bacteria in our guts, and that those bacteria, our microbiome, actually direct much of our immune and even our hormonal existence, right? So the literature demonstrates that women who experience inflammatory responses are more symptomatically sensitive, right? So if I and the man next to me have the same inflammatory messenger circulating, I'm going to feel it more. And there probably are some, you know, ancestral reasons evolutionarily for that, for the hyper-responsivity on the part of the woman, really the heart of any tribe, right, is the woman. And so, you know, we could explain it in that way. But because we're beginning to understand depression as potentially often an immuno-inflammatory condition, it's no wonder that there is a greater manifestation clinically of, you know, what all of us are experiencing in terms of our body's responses to the very, you know, sick lifestyles we're living. So it's, I think, very relevant for the female population. But, you know, I get many, many, many messages from men around the world who are saying, well, why is your book written for women? We're dealing with this too. So I know it's not exclusively a female problem, obviously.
But the message, the solution, is the same for men and women. We've got to change our diet. We have to heal what is compromised, what functions are compromised. Look at whether the thyroid or adrenals or your gut, or whether you've got, you know, low vitamin D, or, you know, whatever. It could be so many things. We have to bring it all together and get back into balance and harmony. And, you know, I think your book is so fantastic. You know, Kelly, I heard that you couldn't get on major media. Is that true?
It is true. It's amazing. I actually, shockingly to me, got a very generous contract with a mainstream publisher, HarperCollins, and, you know, I didn't expect this book to go anywhere because it's so controversial. I had a mainstream contract, and they are very used to waltzing their authors, you know, right onto the Today Show and Dr. Oz and, you know, Fox and CNN and all the rest of it. And a month before the book's launch, you know, I got a teary phone call from the publicist at Harper saying she couldn't book a single minute. And in fact, where they were getting threatening feedback from certain major networks here in New York that if they were to cover the book, it would be negative press for us. And so I wasn't surprised because all of these networks are pharmaceutically funded. So I knew that we would have to rely on mainstream, on alternative media, independent journalism. And so I rallied the troops, and, you know, there's apparently an incredible receptivity for this message in independent media because, you know, we landed on the New York Times bestseller list within the first week. You know, we sold out on Amazon in 24 hours, and it's profound to me because it means that there's a new story about how to communicate the truth And we don't need to rely on pharmaceutically funded outlets to put a microphone to these issues. So I actually found it really inspirational and moving, but it's very true.
Yeah, so interesting. No, it would be a very threatening book to the mainstream media and their sponsors, for sure.
Exactly,
so it's
yeah.
good to know that we have another model that's another paradigm working that's getting truthful information out.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, then conversations like this are a part of that. So thank you so much
absolutely, for
having me.
Yeah. Well, we get out there all over the world, so I'm just thrilled to be able to share your message and your story and the strategy for healing and hope. That's the most important thing. So I guess it's here at the end of the show. We've had this profound conversation with Dr. Kelly Brogan. Go visit kellybroganmd.com for more information. Pick up Kelly's book, A Mind of Your Own. And Dr. Kelly Brogan, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And for all of you listening, thank you for joining me. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye.